Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. We are here at the Berlinale, tucked away in some lounge. I'm very happy to be joined by Festival Stalwart. I love that phrase.
Stalwart. God, it makes me sound like I'm like 800 years old.
Oh, really? When I hear the word, I think I associate it with some like video game I played once, like as
really?
A kid. So it means like a knight or something in that game.
Oh, okay. Well, that's much better than the associations
like
I have with it, which is just like, I don't know, it's like warts or something. I have this like...
It is unfortunate. Like,
she's the wizened old crone of the Berlin Alley.
I'm here with the...
the wizened crone of the Berlin Alley. Thanks.
Jessica King.
Hello, Nick.
Hello.
This is my first one of these as a blonde, so I mean, I feel like your listeners should definitely know
true,
that.
Yeah,
so it's a completely different thing
yes,
now. It's like a whole new lease on life.
Completely different perspective.
Yeah.
Well, this is only a couple more days, maybe, of like new premieres really to come. I don't even know that there are that many.
No, there aren't any more press screenings after today.
There's plenty still to catch up on. So this is going to be a grand podcast, but we'll start. I kind of want to start with a movie that one I was really anticipating, and it's very strange. It's called Pepe, and it's from...
His name is Nelson Carlo de los Santos Arias.
Yes. I liked his movie Cocote.
Cocote, yeah.
Quite a bit. He's a Dominican filmmaker. I thought really interesting based on that feature. And this one, he doesn't disappoint in terms of just like going for it.
Yep. He goes for too many bits of it, I think. Yeah.
I think I gave like a little description of this movie on an earlier episode, so I'll turn it over to you to get something fresher.
Well, I don't know how fresh I'm going to be. I struggled through a review of this yesterday. And yeah, it's funny because it's one that we were just saying before is getting bizarrely good, like word of mouth.
Yeah.
Even though at my screening, certainly, there were a lot of walkouts within the first... Like from about 10 minutes in until about an hour in, there was just like a constant snowdrift of people leaving the cinema. And which in a way is a shame because about an hour into this movie, this 2-hour movie, it starts to tell an actual story and it actually gets coherent to a certain degree. And I did like that part.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, I mean, this, the other thing is like, I'm really surprised to be more negative on this than most people, because this is the kind of film that I'm always accused of like being in the bag for. It is kind of, uses a whole different like variety of techniques. You know, at times it's like hybrid documentary, at times it's, and then there's like actually staged parts and like really recreated period parts. There's some fantastic nature cinematography going on that we'll talk about in a bit as well. But yes, my issue with this film is that it is based around, or it's certainly inspired by, this very bizarre incident in history, in recent Colombian history, which was in 1993 after Pablo Escobar was killed in a gunfight at his hacienda.
On the rooftop, right?
On the rooftop, yes. And there's all of these stories about whether he actually shot himself because, you know, somebody like Pablo Escobar could not possibly be taken down by mortal bullets. Anyway, on this hacienda that he had spent a lot of his time on and had built this like massive rambling estate, basically, he had essentially a personal menagerie, a zoo full of exotic animals, none of which were indigenous to the region and or even to the continent in some cases, including he had brought over, like, well, I think 20 years before or something, 4 hippos, one male and 3 females. And the hippos had multiplied, and there were, like, I think there was like 24 or something of them by the time he was killed. And so suddenly when he was killed and the hacienda was sort of opened up, then there was the problem of what to do with all of these animals. Many of them got sent to zoos and things. But the hippos, despite the fact that they are actually indigenous to Africa and not to the Americas at all, really were thriving in that particular climate, in the warmth and in the wet. It's near the Magdalena River in Colombia. So they left them, but they were sort of enclosed in the hacienda, which has now become a nature reserve. However, then, sometime later after that, one of the males went rogue and escaped from the hacienda. He became known as Pepe. He actually escaped with a with a female as well, with his girlfriend in tow. Wait, really? Yes, yeah. They're lovers on the run. This story is just incredible. And then they escaped into the Magdalena River, where Pepe certainly started to terrorize the local population a little bit. Now, the thing is, this is an incredible story. Yeah. I freaking love the story. And the fact that you have watched this movie and you're going, really? What? I mean, this story is incredible. And the fact you can watch a two-hour movie that is ostensibly about this story and not know that those basic things is, to me, part of the problem with this thing. He comes at it in a really, a really interesting, very inventive way. I mean, 100% points for imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than telling this story, which is already a bizarre and unbelievable story directly, he chooses to sort of narrate it from the point of view of Pepe himself.
Right.
So Pepe has this voiceover, but Pepe is actually voiced by, I think, three different people in different languages.
Yes.
And Pepe's voiceover and his consciousness, his ability to even have words, mm-hmm. only happened to him at the moment of his death. So it is this very portentous, often rather pretentious voiceover that he's trying to sort of like navigate the ideas of various ontological and epistemological philosophical ideas, while also, you know, being a kind of a new being in the world.
Right.
So that there's that part of it. Then there's also all of these archive footage from the killing of Escobar, for example, and then cartoons that were around at the time, mm-hmm. in which Pepe sort of made it in like almost as an anthropomorphized version of himself into children's cartoons. So this is sort of part of this whole thing that Pepe is becoming a living legend, even before he's killed. And there's also then crackly excerpts of the walkie-talkie communications between the military unit, who is eventually sent to go and kill him. And all of this comes, and then there's a whole section which is set in South Africa in the late 70s with a German safari tourist bus, which is also completely perplexing. And all of these things come out of chronological order. You're never quite sure what continent you are, what part of the story is being told, and especially because you don't know the fundamental story. I mean, I didn't know the whole Pablo Escobar part of it until afterwards when I came out and looked up, Columbia Hippo, whatever it was. So anything that you need to do a serious Google deep dive afterwards maybe hasn't done a kind of a basic job of letting us know what this story is. However, then there is this section, about an hour in it starts, and it goes on for almost until the end of the film then, mm-hmm. which is actually really coherent and really interesting. And it's almost a story, I think, of kind of first contact between different species. So it is of the fisherman who works on the river, who is coming home drunk one night on his boat and is then menaced by Pepe, an animal that he's never seen before because, again, not indigenous to the area. So he goes home, he tells his wife, he has this very fractious relationship with.
She's great.
Yeah, she's great, exactly. She has had it with his bullshit. And so this sort of like little, you know, potted portrait of life in that region at that time, which I think feels really well done. And aside from that, the really big thing that sort of kept me, well, didn't actually keep me there, but is the greatest virtue of the film, I think, are these sections of nature photography of the hippos in the river. And there are a couple of these that not only are very beautiful, and I mean, I do like hippos, but not only are, you know, really beautiful and really odd, but they're just sort of like miraculously serendipitous. Like, I don't know how long you have to stake out the river. You know, I actually started thinking, are these animatronic hippos? I mean, how is he getting a performance out of the hippos? How is he getting them to, you know, surface on cue and that kind
of like
thing?
The foreground and then the deep background.
In the deep background, and sometimes Candelario, that's the fisherman, will like be on his little boat, like putting, and he will literally just leave the frame, and one of the hippos just surfaces right then, and you're just like, how did, what?
It's like he's off screen with the bullhorn. He's like,
yes,
rise
exactly.
now.
Yes, this is your cue, Pepe. yes. One of the things I was realizing when I was writing about it as well, and I think it's the same for talking about it, there is a danger, I think, of making the film sound way more interesting than it is. Yeah. I mean, it is conceptually interesting, and there's loads of really interesting stuff going on in it.
Right.
But I was so frustrated watching this movie. I think because I could see those things poking through.
Yeah.
And then was just really, most of the time, was just felt completely at sea. And, you know, this is, again, as I say, somebody who is normally in the bag for this kind of approach. And it didn't work for me.
Yeah. It was really a frustrating experience. You know, there's just also like this really long runway to the movie where you're like, is this the beginning? Is this the beginning? You know, is this still the beginning? And the way it is kind of exploded into these different fragments of time or of where it is and of method, of aesthetic. I have to admit that with Kokote, there is an aspect of that in that movie as well. But I think because there's this spine of like revenge.
Yeah, it's a revenge movie. So you kind of know you can, you're allowed to go deviate from the central thing if you know what the central thing is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I guess Pepe is the center, but it's not enough the way he's deployed.
Yeah, and also because, I mean, certainly I didn't know anything of this story before, so I don't know who Pepe is. I don't know why we're... I was like, is this an invention? Is the idea of the hippo who has been killed in Colombia, which actually doesn't super come across either.
Yeah.
But like, is that a fiction? So...
Yeah, yeah. I happen to know of Pepe.
Close personal friends.
Pepe is a close personal friend. Our families have had dinner together. So just up front, you know my bias. But I just agree, co-signed to what you just said. And then surprising that people have liked it. And because it seems like a classic example of a movie where people would just be like, I don't know what the hell was going on.
Yeah.
Would flee in droves. So I guess I kind of like that. I mean, because technically there's so much interesting going on. The documentary stuff, I mean, if I'm reading the credits right at the end, he said he shot him on 16.
Yeah.
Which makes it all the more incredible.
And each of the locations, and I mean, there's a location in Namibia, there's Colombia, yeah. There is South Africa as well, and there's actually two different locations in Colombia as well. So, but each of those locations, if you look at the credit, there's listed a fiction crew and a non-fiction crew. So there obviously were, like, there was a documentary crew hanging out shooting on 16, I guess.
Yeah.
For God knows how long. And like some of these, I'm always very, you know, ambivalent about the use of drone,
right.
But some of these drone shots are insane.
Yeah.
Like they go so crazy high up, and you can see, I particularly like the one where you can see the weird line that is down the middle of the river where differently silted particulates or whatever meet, and he manages to get like the hippos to just be perfectly in the middle of that line.
Yeah,
I mean, really amazing. So yeah, some of those that nature photography, the documentary photography is incredible.
Yeah, I do have to wonder now. I'm trying to remember in the credits if there is a lot of VFX, you know. Composite, digital composite.
I don't think that there was, though.
Really?
I really don't think that there was. In fact, and for those in the know, the one thing I will say about this movie, it is the most Hubert Bowles Fund movie I have ever seen in my life. So the Hubert Bowles Fund, which is the Rotterdam fund,
yeah.
Which tends to fund extremely abstruse and quite difficult things. When that logo came up at the end, I was like, yeah.
Yep, correct. One interesting thing about the quality of the Pepe voiceover, I mean, this is just sort of strange that there are like three films this year that have this same sort of, you know, weird kind of husky robotic kind of sounding voice. It sounds a bit like when they would disguise voices in like interviews. It's this one, Dahomey, which we'll talk about
in a minute,
and then yeah. Empire also. He has kind of like a robotic voice.
Oh, yes, I guess, yeah. Fabrice Luchini.
Fabrice Luchini, yeah. They kind of distort his voice.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's just an awful character. That weird prancing, preening.
So, I don't know. A lot of experimentation going on with vocal distortion.
I mean, I think, yeah, but the vocal distortion as well in Pepe is also kind of a problem for me. He has this, I think just because Pepe sounds like a bit of an asshole, like, I mean, which is unfortunate. But he has this sort of like hoof, hoof, hoof.
Oh, yeah.
Noise that he makes so frequently. And I'm not sure if it's like a chuckle or if he's snorting or what it is, but it's just kind of irritating after a while. And then once you start to notice that he is speaking in these three different languages, you're suddenly like, what? Hang on, is he the same Pepe or is he three different Pepes or what the hell?
Yeah.
These things are never really explained. And there's the motivation for changing from one language to another, which is also kind of difficult for me to hear because I'm reading the subtitles, obviously, in English.
Right.
But then I, you know, do actually register that, like, oh, this part is in Spanish. And apparently not even Spanish, it's Castellano. I don't know. Anyway, what the hell?
And another one is...
It's a Namibian dialect.
A Namibian dialect.
Yes, yeah. And then there's the Afrikaans as well.
Oh, there is Afrikaans. Oh, okay. Yeah. So I don't know. I guess he holds multiple citizenships as a result of his travels.
Yes.
So I guess I will say I do aspire to watching this movie again, knowing what the pieces are and then seeing if I can assemble them in some way when I see it again.
Yeah, I would love to watch like a new cut of this movie. I would watch the hell out of a cut that's at least half an hour shorter and is just a little bit more disciplined.
Yeah, which pains me to say because, again, I was so excited about Cocote. Mm. So it goes with Pepe. Let's talk about...
Should we go into Dahomey then?
Yeah,
because
well,
actually,
why not?
Because I think it's a really... All of the flaws that we're talking about in that voiceover, it's the opposite in Dahomey. It works incredibly mm-hmm. well in Dahomey. So Dahomey is the Matty Diop hybrid documentary, I suppose we can call it. Dreamlike documentary, I mean, because it has very imaginative flights of fancy in it as well. About the recent return of 26 of the many thousands of looted artifacts that France, as the colonial power, took from the kingdom at the time, the kingdom of Dahomey, which was recently immortalized in the Woman King. That's the kingdom
Ooh.
That is the mm-hmm. home of the Amazons, one of whom is played by Viola Davis. So this very warlike kingdom that existed for 300 years, between 1600 and 1900, I think. And when the French colonial powers went in, they obviously took a whole bunch of stuff. And it's only recently that these issues of like restitution and of restoring stolen antiquities mm-hmm. Have really come to the fore. So it was agreed to make this kind of, you know, on one hand, you can look at it as quite a token gesture of only 26 of these things are being restored to Benin, which is where the kingdom of Dahomey is in modern-day Benin. So from this, I mean, this is Matty Diop, who previously made the film Atlantics. She made her feature debut with Atlantics. She was a very well-known shorts filmmaker before that, a very successful shorts filmmaker before that as well. So Atlantics premiered in Cannes competition. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, it was a big hit. And yeah. So this, to me, was one of my most anticipated films coming into this.
Yeah.
I think it's incredible. I think, like, Dahomey, it's 68 minutes long. She does so many things in it, but it mm-hmm. never feels overcrowded or overstuffed in the way that Pepe does, for example.
Yeah.
You always know where you are and you know what her thoughts are, but you come out with just this incredibly nuanced understanding of
yeah.
all of the issues surrounding the idea of restitution, and not just the idea of restitution, but also homecomings in general, mm-hmm. ancestors, the whole... The last section of the film is in a kind of a university debate style situation, mm-hmm. which Matty Diop staged, and she like set out a casting right. note for these for the students.
Interesting.
But they are obviously themselves. It's
yeah.
not like she hasn't written a script exactly. Mm-hmm. And just with even within that, like it's shot brilliantly that section, but even within that, you just get these amazing, really insightful different points of view, whether the return of these artifacts is an insult, whether it's something to be celebrated. And it brings up many different ambivalences and ambiguities involved in it, where, you know, a more simplistic filmmaker would certainly just be kind of using this as a manifesto for the restitution of more stuff or whatever it is. There's all of this complication that she introduces so flawlessly. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, as we're talking about before with the voiceover, that really elevates this, I think, and actually sometimes I got a little bit, you know, hairs on the back of the neck mm. with it. One of the statues is of one of the kings of Dahomey called Gezo. And so Matty Diop basically imagines Gezo's voiceover.
Mm-hmm.
And he has this very, it's a much more pleasant voice, I guess, than Pepe's. But it has this sort of like dark reverb on it. Mm. It feels, I think I wrote my thing, it feels a little bit like it's rushing through tunnels of time mm. at mm-hmm. you. It's got this sort of weird echoey vibe to it. But yeah. he, and also his character, the character that she imagines him having, sort of comes across really clearly. And mm-hmm. and he's proud and scornful and full of kind of disdain for not only his French captors, but also then when he comes back, like to what Benin has become, he's full of trepidation about what that's going to be. So just even thinking in that way suddenly opens up this whole idea of how we are serving our ancestors, mm-hmm. and how our ancestors are living through us, and should they? That's the other thing as well, because Gezo and Dahomey itself, you know, part of the whole thing is about one of the girls in the university debate says something like, I was always told I was descended from slaves, but I was descended from Amazons. And, it, you know, she's pointing out the importance of people knowing their heritage, because that, you know, it instilling some pride in them. And that's true. But at the same time, Mati Diop takes care to complicate that again, because the Kingdom of Dahomey itself was actually derived a huge amount of its wealth from slavery, from conquering and enslaving its neighbors. And there's a particular throne that she points out, which is actually made, the figurines carved into the throne, which is one of the restored antiquities, one of the 26. Is this throne, and there you basically the king sits on representations of people that he has enslaved. Yeah. So, you know, nobody comes out with this particularly well, and there's no sort of unspotted, purely virtuous victim in this whole thing. Every, you know, these sort of grey areas, and to be able to get all of that across and be entertaining and beautifully shot in 68 minutes, I think is just really amazing.
I was amazed as well. It just felt like every shot is doing something, you know, and just the play of gazes that it's constantly exploring too, showing people and encountering these artifacts as they are just on the way for one thing. So you see people involved transporting it or studying it or even just walking by. At one point, there's this great scene where I think I wasn't clear if they were actually involved in transporting it, but they sort of were dressed like construction workers are just sort of hanging around by it, and then they're kind of shooed away by a guard. And then you get people who actually are coming to some sort of exhibition or unveiling. I mean, this must be like catnip for a documentarian to be filming someone from behind a glass case. You just get these completely unfiltered,
you know, reactions gazes and reflections.
Yeah. And also just play of emotions too. You can see people going through emotions just watching it, of like, yeah, just wonder and curiosity, sometimes also sort of in some sort of angst, you know?
Yeah.
So you're seeing all of it. It's not just like happy and overjoyed. Everything's there. It's complex.
Yeah. And the facility that they show us that they have built basically in Benin to house these treasures. You know, one of the issues that also comes up is that one of the reasons that ex-colonial powers say for not returning these things is that actually the backward little countries that they came from don't actually have the facilities to be able to you know, properly display them or to properly care for them. And so the Beninese, you know, made a huge effort and spent a lot of money, which is also comes in for a brief critique during that university debate, building this facility. And it is like to show these 26 antiquities, and there is, as Nick is saying, there's the opening and everything. Mm-hmm. But there's also a kind of sense of, and not just like the money involved in it, but there's also somebody else talks about how are we going to ensure that, you know, poor rural people can come, and how are we going to make sure it becomes accessible to them. But even then, to me, it was in the persona of Gezo. There's a sense that he's almost looking at this facility and realizing how much Benin has changed. And also there's the sense that they're building this facility to the standards of the oppressors, basically. So they're building this facility in order to create a place that is acceptable to the people who stole this stuff from them in the first place. So there is this kind of slight sense that they're almost giving in or something by building this. And the building itself is, you know, looks a bit like any of those buildings that could be anywhere in the world.
Right.
So when you're talking about something that is so much part of like national pride and a very specific culture, then to see them in this slightly sterile and generic environment also comes with its own weird mixed emotions. And to, in 68 minutes, be able to communicate all this, to give you space to be able to have these thoughts and to notice these very, very tiny little nuances is really incredible. I don't know why this movie is as good as it is. Like, it should be a total mess, and it's absolutely not. There's all of the things that it does, it's in such a short space of time, and, you know, all of, again, these different modes that it works in.
Yeah.
And yet you compare it with something like Pepe, and it's like almost like half the length of Pepe, and yet it feels so absolutely confident and absolutely single-minded, mm-hmm. and you're never in doubt that she knows what she is doing at every point. I really think it's great, and I'm excited for it to get out there in the world.
Absolutely. And I mean, just on that, how it's done, like the fact that it's short, because, you know, sometimes, because I'm a huge Frederick Wiseman fan, and there he kind of will stretch a big canvas to give you the space to, and, you know, he's all about making sure that he's not deciding anything for you. And in this case, it's almost like she's leaving that openness there as well. But there's something about not elaborating too much. I guess a lapidary kind of quality, but also not one that has a finality to each of her insights and perspectives.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It isn't drawing a whole bunch of conclusions.
Yeah.
But there is also something remarkably, it takes a remarkable degree of filmmaker confidence to be able to trust the audience to fill in those things. And I find, certainly, if I notice that kind of that process happening, I am so grateful that I will probably, you know, go overboard. I will, you know, rush all of my thoughts towards the place that I'm being pointed, just because I'm being given that space to be allowed to do that.
Yeah. Sometimes when I see like a movie that's really successful at something, I'm haunted by like the bad version of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, you know, this has a storytelling device in it of the statue obviously being transported and so being locked in. And so the whole screen goes to darkness. And I can just think of the bad version of the movie that uses that device, you know, or the bad version of the monologue. But anyway, yeah, great movie.
Great movie.
So how do you follow that?
Mm.
Well, actually, you know, Through the Graves.
Oh, yeah.
That's also nonfiction, right?
It is, hybrid? Yes. Yeah.
And just by way, I guess I did this on the first episode, but to indicate that I keep finding that a lot of my favorite movies
are documentaries.
Yeah.
This year, I was actually, that's one of the things I was just writing about earlier. I don't know if I'm in my nonfiction era or...
You've had enough of the lies.
Yes, exactly. Give me some pure, unfiltered truth, baby. But certainly this festival, I've noticed that apart from the amazing La Cocina, which I am going to keep on shouting out, even though I know you've already talked about it. But apart from La Cocina, almost all of my favorite films here have been hybrids or have been documentaries.
Yeah.
So just last night, actually, I saw the new Travis Wilkerson sort of essay film called Through the Graves, The Wind is Blowing. And it is a very playful, metatextual essay film, I guess you could call it, about a period of time in which he was living in Split in Croatia. And he says, he appears on camera himself at the very beginning. This is absolutely beautifully shot film as well. A lot of it is in black and white and very, very high contrast black and white. Mm. And he shoots, especially Split's very ragged and crumbling and graffitied outskirts with this incredible high definition black and white, so that the very frequent sort of puddles of water and things become like almost silver like mirrors. It's really, really stunning looking. Anyway, at the very beginning of this, he explains that he and his family had moved to Split, and he's a teacher as well as a filmmaker, and he wanted to make a film about the end of Yugoslavia.
Hmm.
And he immediately contradicts that by saying, but like, how on earth am I going to do that? So I didn't make that film, and I made this film instead.
Mm-hmm.
And we go into Through the Graves. And so the main character, if there is one in Through the Graves, is absolutely just a hilarious character. You couldn't make this guy up. He is a police detective in Split who has been tasked with solving mostly the murders that he is asked to solve are murders of tourists in Split. And so I think we go through this sort of circumstances of maybe four or five of these murders, all of which are unsolved. And throughout that, we get him talking like directly to Travis Wilkerson about these investigations and things and about these murders in a very dry, very funny, very I mean, I don't know if you know any Croatians, but in a very Croatian manner. Really? And a lot of it is about like just how much they fucking hate tourists. So one of the reasons that he can't solve any of his crimes is that nobody wants to help him because they're like, oh, it was just a tourist. And then, and which sounds terrible, well, it is terrible, but then there's a whole section later on where Travis Wilkerson shows us footage, like CCTV camera footage of tourists in Split. And by the end of it, you're like, actually, I'm surprised there are as few murders as there are. They're all like pissing in fountains and getting drunk and vomiting, and it's like stag parties and hen parties, and it's just the absolute scum, and they are treating the place, you know, with absolutely no respect. So in between all of these, in between these segments, when we're talking to with this detective, we're also then just getting this very mercurial but really incisive history of especially Yugoslavia in World War II, during World War II, and the rise of fascism, and the indigenous, I guess you could call it, fascist party in Croatia now, which is very closely allied with its football team. And, you know, Wilkerson just traces these things. He also, Wilkerson, I think, really works. He has a really beautiful voice, and he does a lot of his own voiceovers. And they're, you know, they're witty, but they're also just really... they're just really smart. It's a really smart voiceover, and tells the stories of various, you know, martyrs to the cause and partisans. And he has like what I think is you know, brilliantly righteous fury against the fascists, especially. And a real scorn for them as well, because the fascist party in Croatia, basically in Yugoslavia, this was before Tito. So they came in and assumed power when the Italian fascists, who were at the time allied with the Nazis, came in and basically occupied Yugoslavia. And so they were installed as a puppet regime, but somehow have, in the national consciousness, this was the first time that there was such thing as an independent Croatia. Okay. So the birth of their actual nation is inextricably tied up with fascism. And he has a whole section which is about all the fascist symbolism, which is now, which is like unbelievably prevalent in graffiti. So not just swastikas, but they have their own fascist symbol, which is like a U with a little cross inside it, and it is everywhere. He has a moment in the middle where he decides he's going to spend 1 hour. He puts a timer on his clock and he's going to spend 1 hour and go around just as far as he can from his house and take a photograph of every single one of these fascist symbols that he sees painted somewhere. And we get like, I think it's, I counted them, I think it's about 58 shots. Jeez. And in many of those shots, there is more than one. In fact, in one, there's like just swastikas cascading down a lamppost. So there's like 20 in that one shot. And then at the end of that sequence, you actually hear his voiceover saying, I made it to 26 minutes and I had to stop. So like all of those that he saw. So he's righteously furious about all the things we should be furious about, but he's also very funny about all the things we should be funny about, and the funny about the things that should be, that that are absurd. Yeah. And that particularly comes across in the persona of that detective, Ivan, who is just a wonderful character as well. So it's, I really, just really, really enjoyed this film.
Yeah.
I think it's really great.
This is a movie I regret not being able to see. I had to make a hard decision. I regret it. But also, just if people don't know necessarily Travis Wilkerson, and yeah, he's kind of draws on like a monologuist kind of tradition as well. And he has like a live version, which is how I saw Did You See Who Fired the Gun, where he's kind of operating slides, I guess, while he's narrating it. Or
yeah, and did you see Who Fired the Gun is about his own grandfather.
Yes,
and his discovery that his own grandfather was a member of the KKK and was and murdered black people. And he actually refers to that in this this one as well, not to the film, but he refers to the fact that his grandfather was a Klan member. When they go and visit the concentration camp that was built by the fascists in during World War II in Croatia. And he goes and he visits it with his two children. And again, there's this wonderful, I was trying to think about how to put it, but there's something about essay films like this, or confessionals, or whatever you want to call them, that it's almost like they use the aesthetics of propaganda, like agitprop aesthetics, because there's lots of like text on screen and big bold things and that very high contrast stuff. And he has this sort of filter that he sometimes puts over, which is, he tells us later, is kind of was his attempt to make a like an animation, but it went wrong, and so now it's just like looks like splatters of red, which does look like splatters of blood.
Wow.
So anyway, so he has all of these things which are very kind of punchy, graphic, agitproppy kind of stuff, but in the service of the exactly opposite agenda to propaganda, which is to put forward a sense of doubt and uncertainty mm-hmm. and thinking again about things, yeah. Thinking things through more. So this whole section where he's in the concentration camp, which was actually, I think, the biggest concentration camp not built by the Germans, anyway, in Europe. And in this particular one area of the camp, they reckon it was between 90 and 100,000 people were murdered, most of them with knives, because they didn't have the technology to make gas chambers. Anyway, he brings his kids along, and immediately we hear his voiceover saying, yeah, I brought my children along because I thought it was important that they know this, and especially because they know his partner's parents. His partner's father was a German soldier in the Wehrmacht in World War II. And then he says, also, my grandfather was a Klan member, and my children should know these things and whatever. And then he immediately is like, and I was there maybe 2 minutes, and I realized this has been a terrible mistake because they were just absolutely traumatized by it. It's really, and so then he has to buy them a puppy. But I mean, so it is this sort of like very personal and very sort of sweeping thing that takes in, you know, really opposite ends of the scale of absurdity and fun and hopefulness, and then a really anguished reckoning with personal history and with one's personal history's place within larger history in general. I think it's really smart and just also really entertaining.
I can't wait to see it. So that's Through the Graves, The Wind is Blowing. Is that a line of poetry that I should know?
I don't know. It's anything that you're necessarily going to know. I think it's a line from one of the resistance fighters, one of the partisans, I think. Actually, I'm just going to say one more thing.
Yeah.
There was a fantastic little moment in it. There's a whole section about a particular resistance fighter, basically, who has a small statue erected to him. And Wilkerson goes in and tells the whole story of this guy, which is an amazing story anyway. But the reason that he tells it, the reason that he's like very intent on saying, like, why does this guy have a statue, is because he heard about this statue because some old basically neo-Nazi fascist guy got really drunk and then tried to deface the statue, but ended up pulling the statue back onto himself and was found trapped there with a broken leg underneath the statue the next day. And Wilkerson's fantastic kicker to the end of it was like, and here is, I can't remember the guy's name, which is a shame, the guy to whom the statue is of, like Radu, whatever it is. And so here's Radu still fucking up fascists 70 years after they killed him.
That's great. Let's talk about one more movie, and this is, I forget which section this is in.
It's in Forum.
Forum. Yeah. Okay, Forum.
It's
title.
A very Forum film.
It is a very Forum film. Yeah, I should have guessed. This vast wilderness. So this one's called The Human Hibernation. And basically, you know, I kind of went into this pretty cold. It's about people who are living in nature, except this seems to be some alternate universe, kind of, because the movie opens with people waking up, basically, you know, a series of people waking up in the wilderness. But it's a movie that's kind of, I shouldn't even say it's about humans, because it's the consciousness is diffuse among humans and fellow creatures living in nature, especially cows, but also chickens.
Snails.
Frogs.
Snakes. horses.
Goats.
There's everything.
All things great and small. And it's just an incredible exercise in imagining yourself into the mindset of like being just a creature among creatures. First of all, there is this kind of fiction that these humans hibernate for part of the year and they return to a house that doesn't even necessarily seem like it's theirs. It seems like it almost belongs to the animals who are hanging out in it. And when they're talking about their lives, they talk as if they're... first of all, they talk a bit like they're storytellers or interview subjects, recounting as if, you know, to a complete stranger, which we are to their ways, what life is like for them. And you get this very pre-civilization style social structure sense. We kind of glom onto one in particular, although we start with a kind of very horrifying perspective of a child waking up in the middle of the wilderness. I mean, I have a lot of thoughts sort of jumbled about this one, but one is just about what it means to have a place in nature and what solitude means. Are you alone in nature or are you not? otherwise, you just have the sense of these humans as these like migrating creatures. So the idea that it is like a desolate existence isn't necessarily true. I feel like there are a lot of movies I'm seeing, like, almost maybe it's since the pandemic, I don't know, in the past few years, that are revisiting our relationship to nature and what it means now. Anyway, it's a movie I'm still processing, but yeah, I found pretty absorbing, entrancing even.
Yeah, absolutely, me too. I mean, well, we saw it together, and then I had to go and see The Extremely Stupid Spaceman immediately afterwards. So, but yes, I really, really like this. It's a new filmmaker, I think.
Yes.
Anna Cornudella,
yeah, thanks,
Castro. I think she has a background in visual arts, which I think you can really see coming through. These amazing macros of nature, and of,
yeah,
there's one particularly fantastic, just two snails, like, and the sound design is incredible. The snails, there's that sort of like sticky osculation sound that they have when they rub off each other. Anyway, amazing. Yeah. So like really lovely stuff, and very, very quiet for most of it. Mm-hmm. Very lacks a lot of dialogue, and then we get these sort of bursts of monologues, as you're saying, which are almost like interviews of people telling specific stories from their past or of their upbringing or whatever it is.
Yeah.
In this quite staged manner, which is really interesting as well. I think, like, yeah, you mentioned sort of that there's a sense that it's kind of like feels almost like pre-civilization. To me, it felt post-civilization. I think there's something about the houses and things that they occupy, because in one of them I was looking, and there's like electrical outlets and things on the wall, and we see people like having a relatively normal, you know, if kind of rustic lifestyle when they're cooking and when they have that big banquet thing. At the end. So it felt to me like that this is maybe the fourth or fifth generation of humans who have had to hibernate. So of humans who have sort of reverted back to a state of nature, reverted back to being somewhat more in harmony with nature, but then almost, especially I think it comes across in the relationship between the humans and the cows, that there has been some sort of like reckoning there. I mean, because especially, and she has this chicken that she takes care of, and that she's very close to, and I'm just thinking of like of all the animals that we have really abused as a species. I mean, cows and chickens have to be like, we eat an awful lot of them.
Yes.
And so, you know, they have to be right up there. So there's this sort of like, not quite sense of revenge, but I think it's interesting that one of the many enigmatic and unexplained things about this is that it seems like of all of the animals, of all of the wild animals that are out there, the ones that scare the humans the most are the cows.
Yeah.
The cows, there's something uncanny, and maybe that is a kind of a collective guilt. So yeah, for me it had this strange feeling of like when I was trying to work out where in the timeline this is, like, it felt like sort of like a near future where a lot of the tech and the stuff that we have now has, you know, ceased to work, but the structures and things are kind of still there, even if they're overgrown, even if they're, you know, if the animals have sort of taken them over.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a really arresting beginning, because the beginning, I think the premise of the film basically is actually, for whatever reason, human beings have been suddenly, or for however long, have been hibernating, but for some reason, just this one year, one little boy wakes up too early. And so the very early scene that Nick was talking about is this snowy, like frozen, really freezing looking forest, and it's of the little boy sort of his hands scrabbling out of underneath the earth, and then he's by himself, and it's him wandering through. I mean, it's a fantastic little performance as well from the kid, but him wandering through the woods calling for somebody called Clara, and it's incredibly distressing to watch. It actually reminded me of like an extended, expanded version of that scene from Under the Skin with the baby on the beach. Jonathan Glazer's Under the Skin, because there's just something about seeing a clearly very helpless child, and you know that he's not going to know how to get food or how to get warm. He's too young, he's like a really little boy. I'm wandering through, and then even at one point he actually says like, where am I? And he's like, he vocalizes it. It's really heartbreaking. And then he sort of just like sits down in the snow near this pond at some point, and that's the last we see of him. And then we see the rest of the people in springtime actually start to wake up as they're supposed to and emerge from their holes. And Clara, who is the one who he was calling for, she comes out of her little hole. And it turns out that it apparently humans go into hibernation in groups, and usually in pairs. Because that lovely scene of all of the other pairs coming out, and yeah. she's by herself. So she goes off, tries to find the little boy, and doesn't have any success. And it almost seems like some of the interviews and the sort of the stories that we hear from the various people in that community are her on her odyssey to try and find Aaron, the little boy, which itself doesn't seem to work. But then she gets all of these other stories that suggest an almost mystical dimension to this as well, that there maybe this isn't our planet in the future or in the past or whatever it is. It's actually an alternate version connected through ponds.
Through ponds, yes. Sometimes brackish ponds.
Yes. Yeah.
Where they also throw their picnic baskets.
They threw their picnic baskets.
Sort of ritualistically.
I do not understand. Like, I have a working theory in my head for a lot of the other stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know what the picnic baskets mean, but it also... It really didn't bother me that I didn't know what it meant.
It feels like one of those handed down rituals where it's like, we don't know where we're doing it anymore, but we do it.
But we do it.
I find it really interesting what you're saying about, I mean, you didn't say the word, but post-apocalyptic in a way, or post-something.
Yes.
Post-something.
Post-ecological disaster or ecological reordering.
Yeah.
Of some description, or, you know, post-ecological reckoning. Because it really does... in a very, you know, undemonstrative and undemanding way, make you reconsider how we interact with the natural world in a really powerful and kind of lyrical way.
Yeah, yeah. I think that idea of it being post something sort of wafted through my head at one point, but I didn't think of it that way. It somehow like had fleshed out this like mystical or primitive world all its own that I didn't even think how it came to be or why it was this way somehow. And I don't. It's odd because we are super saturated with visions of post something like it's like pop culture is just besotted with it. It's like an industry, you know. It's like the post-apocalyptic industry. So I guess I was really impressed by a movie that created its own world and created its own. What feel like different ways of relating between people. You know, they have this ritual when they emerge from hibernation where they just seem to like commune and like hold each other's heads, you know,
And pat each other's foreheads.
excuse me, in this sort of studied way, which feels incredibly intimate in a different way, you know, that we don't quite know. Like,
and they're also sort of slightly zombie-like afterwards for a little while, actually reminding me a little bit of when I bumped into Nick before he had his coffee before the screening. Looked a little bit like that.
A coffee I was decidedly not allowed to bring into this screening room. This is almost a movie where it's like people who make science fiction sort of like ransack it for for ways or inspiration for how to make something like this exist and feel alive and real.
Yes, and you know, considering, again, I know you've already spoken about it to somebody else, but like considering I left this film and went into Spaceman, which is just like nonstop ridiculous, but also just talking, everything is just in conversation. Every single beat of this thing is just like ridiculously overexplained. And you're like, this is also technically the same genre. And like, look how elegantly and evocatively human hibernation does this, does that.
It's great. And you know, they call it human hibernation. Like they don't have to be coy.
That's what it is.
That's what's happening, which I also kind of love. You know, it's not like named, I don't know, after a city or something, you know, and then you think, oh, is this what happened after? I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, and actually, even when I read the premise in the program, I was like, I mean, I obviously was attracted enough to it to go and check it out, more or less otherwise sight unseen. But immediately, I was asking questions in my own head when I read that premise, because, you know, okay, so humans are now hibernating. So my questions were like immediately, so does that mean, do we live way longer, or do we not sleep like at night when the times we're awake? If we sleep for half the year, then does that mean we don't have to sleep?
No,
like, and all of these sort of like science fictiony things, and like, oh, does that mean that we're all up at night? For the whole, you know, like stupid things. And none of that is alluded to. None of those questions are answered, and you don't even ask them. Actually, there's something the film is aware that it is putting forward an alternate reality, and that we need certain cues to be able to navigate that in any sort of, in any way. And that's the cleverness of this sort of, again, unexplained kind of interviews that she's doing with people, because we can get a lot of information about how that world works. But it is also just so so much an example of what it is talking about, because it is so much an example of actually, you know what, let's just look really, really minutely at a snake sloughing off its skin, or let's look really, really minutely into the eyes of a cow.
Yeah.
And actually, weirdly, either it's not that the answers lie there, but it's sort of like the ridiculousness of the questions maybe lie there.
Yeah,
you just don't ask those questions anymore.
Right. Yeah. No, that's true. I wrote at one point that it's kind of like a covert nature hybrid documentary at a time. It's just, but you're, I mean, that makes it sound like you're apart from it, but it's more that it's trying to get you into their minds in a way of all the, each creature on screen. And I just want to mention that one thing that I kept noticing was also the insightful like camera angles that she would be using. Like when she was filming people, it would often be sort of like down at them a little bit, but from a slight distance. So you're just getting different, literally different perspectives on people. And I also don't want to give the wrong impression by saying that it feels like interviews when people talk. It's almost more like it feels like fireside, like you're talking out, you know, and you're reflecting to others and sharing experience and wisdom. So yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I don't know.
And again, just like beautifully shot, but also just to again call out the sound design, which I think is incredible. The sort of the very minute nature sounds of like crack, not just the animals, but like cracking ice and dripping vegetation, and yeah, you really feel like you can hear the trees growing and you can hear the leaves falling, and yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah, so Human Hibernation, a good film that we saw.
A very good film that we saw.
And we'll talk next about a movie that's also, I mean, kind of in an alternate universe, although it did actually happen. The alternate universe is called 1750s Upper Austria.
The Upper Austria, Styria.
And it is called The Devil's Bath, which I always appreciate when a title is revealed in a way that is actually surprising, and in this case it was. So yeah, what did you make of The Devil's Bath?
I liked it. I mean, in as much as you can like something that is this unremittingly bleak.
Yeah.
I mean, my God, this is bleak. And I think I do, if I have one critique, it's that it is bleak in a way that it offers absolutely no surprises. This is it. Once you understand the trajectory of this film, and it is downward, it does not deviate from that. And so there's very little surprise on that level involved. What is surprising about it is that despite that incredible bleakness, it's really hypnotic. It's very difficult to tear your eyes away. That's partly Martin Geschlacht's amazing cinematography and partly an incredible central performance. Anna Schlag, I don't know how to pronounce her surname. It's a strange, it's got a lot of consonants in it. But she is also the score. She also did the score.
Wait, really?
Yes, yes. She's a musician. Her musician moniker is Soap and Skin. So she did the really remarkable score as well. These sort of scraping violin sounds and really rough-hewn kind of noises. So, yes, this is culled from the actual historical record. And I find it really fascinating. I find a lot of films that are about Jesus, religion is one hell of a drug, right? Very fascinating. And this is definitely that. And it relates to a period in a very sort of not well-known and not well-advertised period. I wonder why they didn't advertise this period in Austrian history. But I mean, I'm sure we can relate this out to various other parts of Middle Europe, certainly, and maybe the rest of the world. And it was especially women in an extremely pious and religious way, but a world that is also very infused with lots of different strange semi-pagan rituals and traditions. Basically, it comes down to a loophole almost. So if you wanted to get into heaven, which they all believed was an actual place that existed, you needed obviously to atone before you died. And so if you committed suicide, you could never do that. You can never atone for the crime of taking a life if you commit suicide, because you're dead. Whereas if you murder somebody, you can then seek atonement for the crime, and when you're executed, you can then get into heaven. That's the technicality there. It's kind of like the mid 18th century Austrian version of suicide by cop, I think.
Whoa.
And so anyway, this is, it revolves around actually sort of two cases of this. We're told in a title at the end that there's over 400 recorded cases of this in just this region. And they are primarily women, and the victims were primarily children, because I suppose that's the easiest victim for a woman to be able to. Yeah, bundle of laughs.
Yeah, really.
But again, incredibly beautifully shot. Like, it doesn't really have any business being this beautiful.
It doesn't.
And especially because what we're seeing is often very horrific. It's also very gory. I mean, there's a lot of blood and mud in this movie, and sort of really quite austere cruelties. It is directed by Veronica Franz and Severine Fiala, we should say, who are previously best known probably for Goodnight Mommy and for The Lodge. So they're known as horror directors, and they really have this incredible sense of atmosphere. This isn't actually a genre horror, really. It is just, it's a drama, but it is a really, really bleak one.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I went back and forth on whether I would think of it as a horror movie, and I think there's almost like a sort of meta thing going on, which is that you know that they're horror filmmakers, so you keep waiting for the other shoe to drop to a certain extent. But I guess I did think of it a little bit as like a horror movie of being being depressed in 1750s and
being a woman, being depressed in 70s women, being married to a guy who's clearly gay.
Because the other reason I thought about that as well is because there are things that happen that are gory, but in a way, they're not treated as frightening to us as an observer, because they're just part of the fabric of daily life, which is brutal. And
well, I mean, the rituals that surround the execution of these women, and the fact that relics like fingers and toes and things are cut off the dead bodies of the executed murderesses and then used as like fertility tokens, and that there's a kind of a party, like quite a bacchanalian party thrown at one of these executions. So it's very perverse. I mean, there's a huge, just really twisted thing going on there. And again, I don't really know why it is so compelling to watch, and it's just a very immersive atmosphere that they create. And one of the things that I was thinking about then when I was reviewing, actually while I was watching the film, before it sort of comes to fruition about this particular like loophole in ecclesiastical doctrine, before then the prologue is a woman killing her child, and so you know, we know from the outset it's going to be about that. And one of the things that it was occurring to me that sort of is not so much the focus, but I think is interesting as well, is just the atmosphere of oppression and oppressiveness is so heavily evoked in this, that I started to think is like, actually, at some point, if you were living in that, if you were a woman living in that situation, maybe like murder is like the only act of free will, like the only independent act that is left to you, because everything else is you being subservient to your husband or your community or God or whatever it is. Whereas, and so it's almost like, because the women are so bolted down and so absolutely no outlet, that actually murder almost becomes like a logical response. It's like, you know, I am a person. How do you express that you are a person if your personhood is just so constantly taken away? And one of the twisted ways of doing that might actually be by taking somebody else's life.
Wow, I didn't know we'd get to that point. For the record, the podcast does not condone murder.
Yes, I'm not saying it's a good thing necessarily. I'm just,
But yeah, I mean, that's something that the movie also does so well, is showing you how regimented everything is. I mean, her mother-in-law.
My mother-in-law. That's right. Nice to know that there was bad mother-in-laws in 1750.
That's right. If you thought it was. But she's just this kind of, I don't know, like the embodiment of like the social structure, just trying to make the central character do everything she's supposed to. And I mean, it's really interesting when like the day after they get married, she wakes up, and I think it shows you something about her character, because it's like she's not immediately sure what to do. Mm. And I guess that's because she even has a certain amount of like freedom of thought, because otherwise it would seem less bewildering to her not to immediately do exactly the thing she's supposed to, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Also, there's the very slight thing that her village is, I don't know, maybe a day's travel away.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
The one that she grew up in. but even that makes her not a local. So she doesn't know the very specific customs to this tiny village, which is not that far away from her own tiny village. Right. But even that means that she's like on the back foot. And at one point, the mother-in-law, she overhears the mother-in-law saying to the husband, you know, you should have married a local girl. Like they're all pregnant by now. But this idea that she is somehow alien and foreign, even though she comes from half an hour away.
Half an hour away. to give a sense of how small,
closed-minded.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Small-minded it is. But at the same time, I could see, wrong film to say this, but the slightest glimpse of how it is a community, you know, and that there must be some members of the community for whom this is a comfort in some way. I mean, what I mean is it doesn't villainize everything just top-bottom, you know.
No. No, I mean, I think it does pretty much villainize the church and just the hypocrisy of that.
Yes.
The absolute fucking hypocrisy of that. But I don't think it villainizes the people who are living under it. I think it actually has sympathy for all of them. Then even at the end, when that title comes up and we understand that this is part of like a whole, at least 400 other cases, recorded cases of this, I was thinking that is just, it is horrible to contemplate, but then it's maybe even more horrible to contemplate the thousands of women who did exactly what they were supposed to and didn't murder anybody and, you know, and lived those utterly miserable, circumscribed, prescribed nothing lives as they were supposed to. So, yeah. I mean, again, it's just me pushing my pro-murder agenda.
Pushing here and coming on here with your pro-murder agenda. But it just goes, that religion doesn't have to be some supernatural figure here. It's just doing what it's doing.
Yeah.
And that's what the horror is.
Yeah. And it's also, I think that it does other atmospheric things that it does quite cleverly is show you almost the beginnings. It's basically, they work in this kind of market economy, I guess. So it's showing you how important the idea of people not committing suicide is to the maintenance of the social order. And that's the reason that there's not a sort of a humanity aspect to why you mustn't kill yourself. There's a work aspect to it. You mustn't kill yourself because you have to be there to do your work. And if you're a woman, you mustn't kill yourself because you have to be there to have children who can then do the work, who can maintain the hierarchies and can maintain this kind of thing. And just noticing how much these facets of religious doctrine are actually have this incredibly pragmatic and very heartless function in the real world.
Yeah. Completely randomly, I saw this Buñuel movie a couple of weeks ago. I think it's called Death in the Garden.
Was it one of his Mexican ones?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's the one that's outwardly should be some sort of adventure in the wilderness or something, but it's really about the complicity of colonialism and the Catholic Church.
Ah, perfect. Love it.
Yeah, love it.
No, I'll check it out.
Yeah. Also, I think it's Michel Piccoli's first film with him, Buñuel, definitely. So, and he plays a priest.
If we're in getting into it, then also the opening film, Small Things Like These, is exactly about the complicity of a community and the Catholic Church.
That's true. Well,
now that we've summed the entire thing up.
We'll wrap it up there. Assortment of totally headlong visions. Thank you for going through them with me.
You're very welcome, Nick.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapol. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapol.substack.com. Thank you for listening.